Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm Krupa Bhatti. Thank you for being with us. Explosions in southern Lebanon tonight as the Israeli military launched a new round of aerial attacks targeting the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Israel Defense Forces spokesman Daniel Hagari made this announcement in a video statement.
In the past hour, we've been attacking widely in southern Lebanon, following the identification of Hezbollah's preparations to fire into Israeli territory. Dozens of Air Force warplanes are currently attacking terror targets and launches to eliminate threats against the citizens of Israel.
Well, earlier in the day, sirens sounded as Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system intercepted rockets over the north of Israel. The IDF said that around 90 rockets were fired into Israel from Lebanese territory and that it destroyed thousands of Hezbollah's launch systems. The cross-border strikes follow an Israeli attack on a building in Beirut's southern suburbs on Friday that killed two senior Hezbollah commanders, along with at least 35 others, including three children and seven women. Well, Daniel Desimone is our correspondent in Jerusalem. Thanks for being with us, Daniel. We've been hearing from the IDF spokesman, Daniel Hagari, there. But what more did he have to say?
Well, it was a fairly brief statement from him about the actions they're taking in southern Lebanon today. But we're starting to see video emerging from southern Lebanon. There's been some, these are clearly very extensive airstrikes. We're seeing some very, very large explosions in some of these videos. So it does appear to be a significant operation. We've seen, you know, really months of airstrikes by Israeli warplanes in southern Lebanon. And pretty much daily rocket strikes from Hezbollah into northern Israel. But these do appear to be quite significant airstrikes. As we're hearing in the bulletin, the Israeli government has, there's, from the home front, has issued some new guidance about people, really saying people shouldn't gather in large groups. It's putting restrictions on people who live north of Haifa. Tomorrow, schools are going to have to hold classes remotely in that area, unless they have sufficient protected areas nearby. So some sort of significant announcements this evening.
Yes, we're also continuing to get more details on an Israeli airstrike on a school in Gaza City that has killed at least 22 Palestinians. What more can you tell us?
That's right. This took place today in Gaza City. Israel says it's a former school and the Gaza run, the Hamas run authorities in Gaza say it was being used to house people who've been displaced. They say 22 people were killed in the strike, mainly women and children. They've said it's 13 children and six women. The Israeli military said it struck a school, named a school, and said it did so because it was a Hamas command and control center that was plotting attacks. The authorities in Gaza have actually named a different school and said that that was the school that was struck. When we've been looked into it, it seems that there's a complex of around four schools. And I have asked the Israel Defense Forces to account for this discrepancy, because they're naming one school, saying that they targeted it, the authorities there are saying a different school was targeted. I'm waiting to hear back from the Israel Defence Forces at the moment.
OK, you're speaking to us from Jerusalem. 101 hostages remain inside Gaza. What have we been hearing from their families, considering the developments in Beirut and those ongoing attacks inside Gaza?
Well, tonight, as we see regularly here in Israel, there were demonstrations throughout the country, but a particularly large demonstration in Tel Aviv by families of people who are still held hostage in Gaza. They want to see a ceasefire deal, a deal that brings the hostages home. And they again are placing pressure on the government tonight, saying that that's what they want to see happen. They don't want to see a widening of this war. We've seen this week the Israeli government setting a new war goal.
Yes.
That relates to the north, relates to Lebanon and Hezbollah. And there's obviously international concern about the conflict in the north between Hezbollah and Israel, really rolling out, getting out of control and spreading further. And so there's been part of the demonstration tonight is about the fact these families wanting ceasefire. They want to see the hostages, their loved ones brought home.
Thank you for your insights there, Daniel Desimoni, our correspondent in Jerusalem for us. Well, Andrea Tenenti is a spokesperson for the UN peacekeeping mission UNIFIL in Beirut. It was originally deployed in 1978 following the IDF's invasion of South Lebanon. The IDF withdrew in 2000, but the conflict flared up again in 2006 when Hezbollah killed 8 Israeli soldiers and kidnapped 2 others in a cross-border attack, resulting in the UN Security Council Resolution 1701. I ask Andrea Tenenti if the mission is in a position to keep peace on the ground in the current climate.
Definitely the situation now is really concerning, and the escalations of these days that we have seen across the blue line are also very worrying, and all actors need to immediately de-escalate. The mission is still Resolution 1701, that our mandate, I would say, is still valid. The main provisions of safety, security, long-term solution are still there. What we need is them implementation from the parties. We also have to remember that before October last year, the south of Lebanon had witnessed almost 17 years of stability since 2006. So we were in the path of moving forward towards at least a partial implementation of Resolution 1701. Then, of course, we had the situation last year, then in October in Gaza, and of course, Hezbollah retaliating against Israel and the situation we are living right now. And the number of people that are also left the south of Lebanon, not only in the north of Israel, but also over 80,000 people have left the area close to the blue line. A solution is still possible, but of course you need a commitment of the parties, and at the moment the situation is more than concerning that could potentially escalate to a wider conflict, and not only a conflict between Hezbollah and Israel, but a regional conflict.
You mentioned the UN Security Council 1701, and that resolution includes the withdrawal of armed groups from southern Lebanon between the Litani River and the Blue Line, that is the unofficial frontier with Israel. It's a line that is constantly being violated, and more so in the current climate, as you've expanded on there. You just said that you need the implementation of parties to ensure this is still an effective resolution. You don't have that right now, sir. What do you have in your toolkit to help stop this conflict?
The implementation, a commitment from the parties to go back to the situation could be a solution. We need a political and diplomatic solution. But what we had at the time was, for instance, part of the resolution was the full deployment of Lebanese army in the south of Lebanon. And there was a deployment of the Lebanese army in the south of Lebanon. Of course, the issue of weapons has been an issue and is still the issue that we are living right now. Also, to define the blue line, because there is no border between Lebanon and Israel. The two countries have been at war since 1948, and there is no border between the two countries. We were working to try to visibly mark the blue line. Violation from the Israeli on the air violation were daily. So these are all things that need to be implemented by both sides. And at the moment, of course, we do not have it. We have daily breaches of the cessation of hostilities. We are still on the ground. We are still working to try to de-escalate the tension in south of Lebanon. We still have 10,500 troops from 49 different countries, providing also assistance to the population. So definitely the resolution has been heavily challenged. But as I said, there is a need for the parties to find a solution. But this can be found not by the mission, because we're here to implement a mandate, but you need assistance of stakeholders, of member states, of the Security Council member states, in order to find solutions. So we are here to provide a window of opportunities for the parties to move forward. At the moment, of course, the conditions are not such for this kind of implementation to take place.
In all your years working for UNIFIL, have you and your colleagues ever been as worried as you are now?
Of course, since 2006, this has been the most alarming and concerning situation, and especially in the last several days, on the last weeks, where we have seen heavy exchanges of fire and also the shelling in Beirut and in other parts of the country. So definitely that's the most worrying situation for the mission. And despite all of it, we are still on the ground, but the region is on the brink of a catastrophic war that no one can afford.
You have just come back from that southern border yesterday. Can you tell us what you saw and what your assessment is of the situation on the ground?
Well, the situation on the ground is that you have a daily shelling all along the blue line, all across the blue line, I would say, and also in the area of operation of UNIFIL in the south of Lebanon, which is around from the Litani River to the blue line, around 34 kilometers. So all that area has been heavily shelled. Most of the villages, I would say 80% of the villages along the blue line, have been destroyed or partially destroyed. So the situation is really worrying, and that's what we see on a daily basis in the south of Lebanon. And yesterday, we also saw it here in the southern suburbs of Beirut.
And that was Andrea Tenenti from the UN there. Dr. Firas Abiad is the Minister of Health for Lebanon. Earlier, he gave me his reaction to the latest attacks in his country.
This is an indiscriminate attack, and we have seen a lot of civilians being involved. In the yesterday's attack, we're reporting 7 women and 3 children. In the attacks before, we had 2 children who also suffered, an 8-year-old girl and 11-year-old boy. So clearly, unfortunately, civilians are caught in the middle of this.
So if it is your position that the pager and walkie-talkie attacks broke international law, and obviously we've had the strike yesterday separately, what action do you want to see next from the international community, if any?
I think that there has to be more pressures on everybody. The Lebanese government has from day one said Lebanon does not want war, and we called for a ceasefire from Gaza to Lebanon. And I think that it's clearly now, after almost 1 year of conflict, that, you know, there is no visible solution to this conflict as it is. And unfortunately, all these attacks, especially involving civilians and causing life-changing injuries, will only increase the indignation and the anger amongst the population.
Whilst you are calling for restraint and you do not wish for an escalation, that is not necessarily the position of the Israeli Defense Forces. What options do you have in light of that?
Well, at the moment, we are receiving reports of a barrage of attacks in the south. And I think that Lebanon has been quite vocal in, you know, its position that we do not want war. However, as a health minister, I have to prepare for the worst. And this is what we have been doing with our health system.
And that was Dr. Firas Abiad, Minister of Health for Lebanon. He mentioned those attacks in the south of the country. We are indeed keeping a close eye on developments on that front as well. He was reacting to the attack yesterday, the airstrike yesterday in Beirut. The casualty numbers have risen significantly. And of course, the rescue operation there on the ground has been continuing throughout the day as rescue workers search through that rubble to find those who are missing. You're listening to NewsHour here live on the BBC World Service. And we will be returning to Lebanon later on in the programme. And that's because among those killed on Friday in Beirut was the man accused of organising the 1983 attack on the US embassy there, Ibrahim Akil. He was a man with a $7 million bounty on his head. We'll be speaking to the CIA agent who was stationed in Beirut at the time.
We never went after these people, even though we often knew where they were. And I knew where they were in the 80s because we weren't willing to kill civilians indiscriminately. We were never going to bomb the southern suburbs.
And the headlines from our newsroom. Dozens of Israeli warplanes have been carrying out widespread attacks on Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. And Elon Musk has backed down in his legal fight with a Brazilian judge who closed down his social media platform X in the country. This is Krupa Party with NewsHour coming to you live from London's new broadcasting house. The game of chess has long been associated with Russia, but like in many other sports, the war in Ukraine has led to Russian teams and players being banned from international competitions. Now, the International Chess Federation, whose president is a former deputy prime minister of Russia, is due to hold a vote this weekend at a meeting in Budapest that could lift all sanctions against Moscow. Ukraine and its allies are mounting a campaign to stop that from happening. Our correspondent Will Vernon reports.
The sixth game of this fascinating chess match, the battle for the world championship between the Grand Master of the East and the West.
Reykjavik, 1972. It's the height of the Cold War, when communism and capitalism squared up on the world stage. A battle was about to take place at the World Chess Championship.
The Soviet team appeared to be taken off balance.
As the whole world looked on, American Bobby Fischer beats Soviet chess grandmaster Boris Spassky. Moscow was furious. In the early days of the USSR, Vladimir Lenin championed the game of chess. Its cunning logic reflected Soviet strength. What the country lacked in technology and economic vitality, they made up for in intellectual superiority over the West. But the man tasked with rolling out chess clubs in Soviet towns, Nikolai Krylenko, clearly made a wrong move, as he was later executed by Joseph Stalin. The culture of chess has long been associated with military strategy. Cold War nuclear brinkmanship was often described as being like a chessboard. In Moscow, the KGB kept a very close eye on Soviet chess players. Embarrassingly, some of them defected to the West. When the Soviet Union fell apart, Russia lost many of its great players and its dominance in the game. But now, the Kremlin is fighting back. Moscow is once again dedicating political energy and screen time to chess. And the war in Ukraine is spilling over onto the chessboard. 2 years ago, the International Chess Federation, known as FIDE, voted to ban the Russian national team and officials from all competitions. But this weekend, a crucial vote will be held at FIDE that could fully reinstate Russia. FIDE delegates have told the BBC that Russia's control of the federation is absolute. They say Moscow has made changes to its constitution, affecting the way decisions are made. And Russia has many delegations on its side from Asia and Africa. Some say bribery takes place, which Moscow denies. But the Ukrainian Chess Federation, supported by Western allies, is trying to prevent Russia's return. President Zelensky has given one of his best men the job of stopping Russia. Alexander Kamyshin made his name as the superstar boss of Ukrainian railways. Now, he's been tasked with derailing Russia's attempts to reinsert itself into international chess. While the chess world might seem a rather insignificant geopolitical arena for some, for the Kremlin, it's crucial. Vladimir Putin said that chess was vital for Soviet survival during World War II. The game is central to Russian prestige and historical identity. And Moscow will be hoping that a successful result this weekend can be a springboard for Russia's exoneration across the board, in sport, trade and international relations. A victory at the Chess Federation today could lead to checkmate against the West tomorrow.
And that report from the BBC's Will Vernon. Let's head to Sri Lanka now, where the country has been voting for its next president. It's the country's first election since it was plunged into economic chaos 2 years ago. A cost of living crisis led to huge street protests and the previous president fleeing the country. The BBC's Samira Hussain is in Colombo.
It's been a momentous day for people in Sri Lanka since they've been able to go to the polls for the first time since that 2022 economic crisis that really plunged the country into one of the worst crises it has ever seen. And it eventually led to the overthrow of the government at the time. So I think a lot of voters came out with that in mind, recognizing that this is their moment to be able to cast the ballot for the candidate that would best represent them. It would actually be a candidate that would represent them.
Some may remember the scenes back in July 2022, those dramatic scenes that were broadcast around the world when crowds overran the presidential palace, jumping into the swimming pool, ransacking the house. People were angry about their economic situation. How has day-to-day life changed since then for the people of Sri Lanka?
We've certainly come away from where people were dealing with, you know, massive queues to try and get food and medicine and petrol. But to be able to get to the position where Sri Lanka is now, the country had to take out billions and billions of dollars in loans from international organizations and neighboring countries. And as a result, they're pretty much an indebted country. And so a lot of the impact of that debt has really been passed on to everyday Sri Lankans. So it means that, you know, basics like food and medicine are just that much more expensive. And taxes are higher and their wages aren't keeping up. So the squeeze is really being felt, especially on the middle class and lower income individuals.
So the problems persist, and that will be at the forefront of any policy agenda for whoever gets that top seat. Who is in the running?
Well, look, there are 38 candidates that are running for president, but there are pretty much three candidates that are what many would refer to as front runners. The first, of course, is Anura Kumara Dissanayake, and he's really positioned himself as this candidate that represents the working class. And he and his party gained prominence in the post-economic crisis era and really positioned themselves as the party that's going to be able to, you know, bring the country forward, and certainly has a lot of support from people that had previously participated in that uprising in 2022, particularly amongst young people.
I want to also take us back a little further to the civil war fought in Sri Lanka between 1983 and 2009. It devastated the country. It scarred so many communities. And I wonder whether the legacy of that war has played on the minds of people, especially minority groups.
Interestingly, this is the first election in which, you know, ethnic politics aren't at the forefront. It hasn't been a primary feature or even a secondary feature on the minds of voters. It's been very much focused on either the economy or bringing in a government that is not corrupt. Because remember, that economic crisis was largely due to the financial mismanagement by previous governments. And so really what people have been talking about is not these kind of minority politics as much, but it's really been about the economy and corruption.
Samira Hussain for us in Colombo there. And counting began with postal votes at around 5 o'clock local time, but results are not expected to come in and become clearer until Sunday morning. As ever, you'll get the latest on that outcome on the BBC World Service when we do have further details. You're listening to NewsHour.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. It is 80 years since almost 2,000 paratroopers from the Allied 4th Parachute Brigade were launched into a failed mission to free the Netherlands from Nazi occupation. Today, their contemporary counterparts have been marking the anniversary of Operation Market Garden with a dramatic airborne display in the Dutch town of Ede, featuring 700 paratroopers from 8 NATO states. Our correspondent Anna Holligan has been finding out why the Dutch place such great emphasis on the memory of a battle that ended in an Allied defeat.
Why is it that the Dutch continue to mark this with such enthusiasm?
I think it's important to commemorate the past, to learn from it, especially with everything going on in the world and also in the Netherlands. So I think it's important to realize what it's like to be at war and how important it is to be at peace. You walk in a region where people fought, so you are there in the history, and the people that are still alive, some of them are here today, so you can say thank you to them, and it makes it very concrete. Now that the veterans, the people that can tell the stories, have died or are dying, we pass it on to another generation, their values, and why it's important to stand up for freedom.
Were you very conscious of this when you were growing up?
I was once every year when we laid the flowers at a cemetery. When I was a little kid, it was very important, and my parents took me to the museum here.
For your sons, they're the ones who will take these stories on. Is that important to you? Your sons are 8 and 5.
Five, almost six. No, it is. It is. We have to tell them about what happened, to remember, and also for them to learn that wars take place all over the world. And our safety is not something that you get for free.
So he was your adopted,
adopted
English
granddad.
Yeah. And what happened to him?
He was like in the trench over there with the Bren gun. And at the time, they were coming through tanks. And they fired at him. And a mortar or a tank shell ricochet piece of big shrapnel entered his belly and came out of his butt. So he was very badly wounded. He crawled over the street, knocked on the door. From let me in, help me. But the baker couldn't understand English, so he smacked the door behind him again.
She thought it was a German.
And there were two nurses in the cellar as well, and they say, hey, that's an English guy.
And the shrapnel is now in the museum.
Yeah, the shrapnel, and together with his beret, is inside of the museum.
Anna Holligan on the anniversary of Operation Market Garden in the Second World War. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Krupa Pati. After months of political uncertainty in France, President Emmanuel Macron has, in the past few hours, unveiled his new government, with the cabinet lineup taking a shift to the right. The country has been in turmoil since the president called a surprise election this summer, which ended in a deadlocked parliament. He appears to have emerged badly weakened from the whole business. Our Paris correspondent Andrew Harding has this assessment of the French leader.
Remember when Emmanuel Macron first took France by storm, sweeping to power as president here in Paris back in 2017, at the age of 39?
Je ferai tout pour qu'il n'ait plus aucune raison de voter pour les extrêmes.
At the time, and consistently ever since, Macron has articulated one overarching goal.
Pour faire barrage à celle de l'extrême droite.
Par les extrêmes et en particulier l'extrême droite.
To stop the extremes, the far right in particular, from ever getting close to power in France. So, how's that going? For the longest time, Macron seemed to have the magic touch. steering France through crises like the Yellow Vest protests. Then declaring war against COVID.
Nous sommes en guerre.
Macron was a smooth-talking moderate who could also, as the political analyst Florence Foscher-King notes, satisfy a certain French yearning for an almost king-like leader.
He's very affable, he's very sharp and clever, an eloquent speaker, so he likes phrases.
He likes the sound of his own voice, is what you're trying to say, perhaps politely.
maybe. His idea is that French people, for some reason, need the authority of a kind of republican monarch, and that's what he's trying to embody.
But playing king is a risky strategy in France, and before long, Macron's increasingly regal style began to grate. Former Macronist ministers like Jean-Michel Blanquer saw power going to the president's head.
When you have, during a long time, the power, you have the temptation to concentrate. And it happened to Macron. Something has been lost. What has been lost is not about the content of his policies. It's much about the style of government, the methods.
Then came this summer's parliamentary elections.
Je dissous donc ce soir l'Assemblée nationale.
Macron called them unexpectedly, hoping to strengthen his hand, warning about the usual dangers.
La montée des nationalistes, des démagogues, est un danger pour notre nation.
But French voters shrugged and veered sharply away from Macron. Many went to the left and far left, but the biggest single winner was the far-right anti-immigrant party of Marine Le Pen. Her national rally became the largest in the country. In the southern market town of Carpentras, contempt for Macron seems almost universal.
When I say President Macron, he should leave.
Ah oui, c'est un charlot.
He's a joke.
And the national rally is now firmly established here, as in much of rural France. Meanwhile, on the left, the mood is one of pure frustration. This is an annual festival for left-wing voices in Paris. People here point out that their broad coalition actually came first in this summer's elections, but Macron has simply ignored the fact.
I think Macron really misled us for a very, very long time.
I feel like we were betrayed.
That feels like, I mean, I can throw my electoral card away, you know.
So where is all this leading? A far-right president, violent protests, a new constitutional order. As in so much of Europe, populism, high prices and concerns about immigration are pushing French voters towards the right. There is still space to rebuild a winning majority in the centre ground. But Emmanuel Macron, his glory years now behind him, will surely struggle.
Andrew Harding with that report for us. Today is World Alzheimer's Day, the most common cause of dementia. It can impact memory, thinking skills and other mental abilities. Over 55 million people worldwide live with dementia, the majority of whom live in low and middle income countries. I've been talking to the journalist and science writer Anthea Rowan, who has written a new book, A Silent Tsunami, Swimming Against the Tide of My Mother's Dementia. She took me back to the moment her mother forgot she was her daughter.
We were on holiday and one evening I asked her if she'd like a drink. Yes, she'd like a drink. I fetched her a cold beer. We sat down and she sort of leant in towards me and she said to me, "Now tell me, when did we first meet?" I really thought that she was joking. I think I laughed. And it was clear that she wasn't joking. And she was a little embarrassed then. And when I said, "I'm your daughter," "Oh, yes, yes, of course you are." But the next morning, she'd obviously been fretting about this all night. And the next morning she flatly and furiously refused that I was her daughter and said that I must be lying and I looked too old to be her daughter. I collected photographs on my laptop as a sort of PowerPoint who's who to try to prove I was her daughter and lending context to that argument that I was her daughter. But she continued to attest that I wasn't her daughter to the point where I heard her checking with people on the phone. "I hear that Anthea is my daughter." I wish somebody had told me. So it wasn't just the forgetting, but it was this completely skewed logic.
That's a lot to process.
It was, and my eldest daughter said to me, how does it make you feel? But I wasn't really able to articulate how it made me feel. I felt very, very shocked. I felt very confused. I really felt at sea. Mm. I didn't know what to feel.
But you knew she had memory loss, so was it that you weren't anticipating this moment?
I didn't know that her memory loss was anything like that. She had had a stroke a few years previously, and the doctors at the time said to us, there may be some transient memory loss. I have since discovered that a stroke can cause dementia, and quite quickly after it, in somebody who's elderly. So I sort of blamed it on the stroke. I blamed it on the fact that she was elderly. I blamed it on senior moments. I think it was just denial. Denial and a total lack of education about dementia. Mm,
which is so important. And you also write about how you felt alienated, but that was very different to your mother's relationship with your sister.
Yes.
And your granddaughter.
Yes, yes, yeah. She knew all of them. She didn't want me. I had been dispensing all her medications and helping her to bed every evening. She didn't want me to do that anymore. She closed the door and said, no, my sister Carol will help me. My daughter Carol will help me. I didn't feel angry or resentful that at anybody else that she did remember. I just shocked and quite numb. I mean, you never, ever expect that a parent will forget you. Mm. And yet I find it is incredibly common in dementia. How that forgetting happens, I think, is different in every case.
And Anthea, you were very honest with your mum about her condition. And I wonder how that played into the dynamic between the two of you.
I was honest to a point. I only ever used the word dementia with her once, and it caused such distress. I never did it again. Because later on, she came to live with me, and she lived with me for 18 months before she died. And she would often complain, oh, my memory is so terrible. And I said to her, oh, Mum, you know, you're old, or we all forget for things. I tried to minimise it for her because she knew what that word meant, dementia, and I wasn't going to use it again.
You also write that forgetting is just the beginning.
Yes, forgetting is just the beginning of dementia. And once I had lived with the condition for some months, quite frankly, it's the least of it. It was the least of it in my case. In the end, it didn't matter that she had forgotten who I was. I didn't mind that. Towards the end, I hated that she lost her sense of taste. That was one of the last things she was able to enjoy was food. So it was one of the last things as her carer that I could make a bit of a fuss over her at meals, prepare things for her that I knew she really enjoyed. Her life was so small by then that if she could have one meal that she really enjoyed and really relished, I made it worth it. But when she couldn't taste, I really hated that. And I hated her hallucinations and paranoia. They brought such fear to her. When her hallucinations began, they didn't appear to be frightening. She would ask, who are those children in the garden? And there was nobody in the garden. And we quickly learnt to say, oh, they're probably just the neighbour's children, or, oh, we know them, it's fine, Mum. Or she would say, who's the man with the children in the garden? My husband was very good at this, and he would say, that's their dad, isn't he great the way he plays with them? And he'd sort of buy into the fiction. But then her hallucinations took on a really terrifying dimension, and they turned into men with weapons and armies, and she would hear voices in the ceiling. And I found that very difficult because it's very hard to comfort or placate. And all the books tell you to distract somebody with dementia. But I'm not sure how you do that when she couldn't walk easily by then. She couldn't read. She couldn't follow a television programme. And she couldn't remember.
Considering you empowered yourself with as much knowledge as you could at the time, why do you talk about feeling guilty in the end?
I think that I felt guilty in the end as a carer. And I think having talked to other carers, having read about other carers, I think it's a fairly universal thing amongst carers. Because as particularly with dementia, it's so difficult for your charge, the person you're looking after, to articulate precisely what they need. So you often feel as if you're falling short. And it's difficult to spend time with them because if you have a mother who has forgotten all of your history, Where's the foundation for a conversation?
When you spoke to your mum about her condition, how did she describe it?
I was determined to approach mum's dementia with curiosity, probably as a consequence of being a science journalist, but also just because I'm a curious person. So I used to ask her often, you know, while she was living with me, about things to understand why she was or wasn't doing things. Why didn't she like having a shower? I realised she didn't understand how to use the taps. I was worried maybe she'd scalded herself. Why didn't she like unloading the dishwasher anymore? And she said to me, I'm afraid to get it wrong. So I realised she doesn't like to get things wrong and she obviously doesn't know where things go now. But I'd never asked her what it was like to have dementia. She told me one day, apropos of absolutely nothing, I feel as if I'm in prison. And I thought, yeah, because her life is so foreshortened.
The words of Anthea Rowan there on her new book, A Silent Tsunami, Swimming Against the Tide of My Mother's Dementia. Just a moment to bring you some news that we've had coming in since we've been on air from the Reuters news agency. Russian forces appear to have struck Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv, hitting a multi-story apartment block. That is according to the regional governor, Oleh Sunihubov. Writing on the Telegram messaging app, he noted two strikes on the city from guided bombs, and there's no word as yet on any casualties. We'll bring you more details as we get them here on the BBC World Service. One of the people killed in yesterday's Israeli airstrikes on Beirut was Ibrahim Akil, a senior commander in Hezbollah who was wanted by the US in connection with the 1983 bombing of the American embassy in Beirut. That suicide car bombing killed 63 people, including 32 Lebanese workers, 17 Americans and 14 others. Among the Americans killed were eight members of the CIA. Islamic Jihad, the group linked to Hezbollah, admitted responsibility for that attack. Later that year, Ibrahim Akil was also a member of the group that orchestrated the bombing of the Marine Corps barracks in Beirut, killing 307 people. This is how it was reported in the US at the time.
The gruesome search for bodies continued today. Rescue workers did in fact find more bodies, and with each discovery, the task became more painful.
The official toll now tops 160 dead and more than 180 wounded. Rescue crews worked quickly today, clearing tons of rubble, but much remains to be done. The list of survivors, dead and wounded, is still being compiled, but the disaster is by far the worst since the Marines have been in Lebanon.
Robert Bayer is a former CIA officer who was working in Lebanon at the time of those attacks. He spent 21 years as a field agent and is the author of many books on security and intelligence. One of those, See No Evil, the true story of a ground soldier in the CIA's war on terrorism, inspired the 2005 film Syriana about the Middle East, the oil industry and espionage. And he was played by George Clooney. I asked him to take me back to that day of the American embassy attack in 1983.
Beirut, at that point, it seemed like peace had broken out. The Marines were driving around, American flags flapping in the wind. It was tourists were coming back, hotels were reopening. This was after the 82 Israeli invasion. It seemed like everything was going back to normal. The embassy was not particularly well protected. The driveway had been left open. In that morning, schools were letting out for lunch. A pickup truck came down the corniche, veered left, and drove into the lobby of the American embassy and exploded. The explosion was such that the Marine on post one, they never found his body. They just found the buttons from his tunic had been melted. And the entire building came down. The CIA station was wiped out. And I think a total of 63 people died, many of them Lebanese. And then came the Marines when a van went through first floor and exploded. And what surprised us was the technique was what they did is they put cement on the floor of the van so the explosion would go up, so the building would come down and kill 241 Marines.
And you lost people you knew well.
I knew him well, the chief of station, the deputy chief of station, the case officers. There was another attack in 84. I knew the people there. By that time, I was in Damascus. And as you know, it became the focus of the Reagan administration's, the hostages being held by the Islamic Jihad organization and other groups. These were cells that were close to Hezbollah, but they weren't really part of Hezbollah, you know, as part of an organization.
Well, let's talk about Ibrahim Akil. He had a $7 million bounty on his head for the 1983 American embassy attack. And then the other bombing, as you mentioned, the U.S. Marine barracks. First of all, why were the Americans never able to get to him?
Well, I mean, we were never prepared. I mean, what's surprising about Hezbollah is they continue to use pagers, cell phones, and walkie-talkies, which are all, it's very easy to get into them. We never went after these people, even though we often knew where they were, and I knew where they were in the 80s, because we weren't willing to kill civilians indiscriminately. We were never going to bomb the southern suburbs. But we did get Ibrahim Akil's boss, participated with the Israelis, who was killed in Damascus in 2008, and his name was Imad Mughniya.
So you weren't willing to kill civilians. Well, therefore, I wonder what you make of Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor, calling the killing of Ibrahim Akil a good outcome. Do you agree?
And I disagree. I mean, I think the fact is that this will cascade into a regional war, very likely. That's the most likely outcome, because Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, cannot. His entire military leadership has been decapitated. Fuad Shukr, Ibrahim Akil, Mughniya, Badr al-Din. I can go on and on and on. And they're just not going to put up for this ever. But it's going to cause a war that's going to spread through the Middle East. I mean, smart people are saying this, and I believe it too. I just think that the bloodshed has got to stop. And settling old scores is just going to, I can't tell you where this is going to go.
Do you believe Israeli ground invasion of Lebanon is imminent?
I think what's happening, and I'm going to go on a limb here, is that Netanyahu wants to provoke Hezbollah to respond to these attacks, which will justify his going into the south to take out the missiles. That's the real threat to Israel, because those missiles can hit Tel Aviv. And of course, Haifa would be a close target. And you know, the estimates are 150,000 missiles. It doesn't matter, because they're all underground and they need to be destroyed. The tunnels need to be destroyed, just sort of like the tunnels in Gaza need to be destroyed. He says he wants to secure Israel's northern border, and the only way he can do that is by going in with ground forces.
And how do you anticipate Hezbollah will respond?
You know, they've been restrained because Lebanon is a failed state. It's economically is completely failed. And half of Lebanese, I'm told, just oppose a general war. They remember 2006. So he's very reluctant to go in. But if these bombings of the southern suburbs continue, he will, only way he can hold on to power and hold Hezbollah together is respond with missiles.
Robert, you've been watching, working and studying the region for decades. Considering all your experience, in your opinion, how dangerous a moment is this?
I have never seen it worse, simply because the threat of Iran coming into this, or the threat of it spreading to Iraq on American forces, will, you know, could turn into, for instance, the Iranians attacking Saudi oil facilities and bringing the world's economy down. And this is, I don't think anybody disputes this, and they're all vulnerable. The Iranians were behind the attack on Abqaiq, that oil facility in Saudi Arabia in 2015 with drones. And then, you know, we get into hypersonic missiles and on and on and on like this. We are at the edge of the abyss.
And the United States, as an ally of Israel, what does it have to do, or what can it do, to call for restraint to ensure that things do not escalate?
Well, no one listens to the United States now. I mean, nobody does at all, because we're party to the conflict. The bombing of Gaza, we're supplying the weapons and the money, as we are supplying the weapons to hit Lebanon. So we're not an honest broker. And nobody running for president at this point would dare withhold Israeli arms shipments between now and November. And then, of course, I don't know what's going to happen after that. But we have no control over either Hezbollah, Hamas, or Israel. They're two immovable forces.
Robert Beyer, ending this edition of NewsHour. Thanks for your company.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.